I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Americans might think income inequality is bad for the country, but apparently most of us have no clue about how wide the gap really is. Asked to estimate the difference between CEO and worker compensation, respondents to a recent survey were wrong by a factor of 10. They thought the ratio of CEO to worker income is about 30 to 1. In reality, the gap is 350 to 1. Maybe we just don't want to believe the gap is that wide. Maybe we're resigned to the further concentration of wealth and think, wishfully, some good will come of it. Today on Midday, another in a series of conversations with Barbara Morgan, Ken Solo, and Michael Reich on income inequality and why it matters. First, the news. Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. A question for my listeners right off the bat. What do you think the ideal ratio of CEO to worker compensation should be in the United States? I mean, for large corporations or even medium-sized ones, with a CEO at the top, what do you think the ratio should be? Should a CEO make 5 times the average pay of his workers? 10 times? What do you think's fair? What do you think is right? And here's the second question. What do you think the ratio actually is in 2014? So think about that for a minute. Give us a ring during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 410-662-8780 as we reconvene our panel for another in a series of discussions about income inequality and why it matters. Today's show continues conversations prompted by the publication in English earlier this year of French economist Thomas Piketty's much-debated Capital in the 21st Century. Since its release in March, Piketty's book became a bestseller. In it, Piketty analyzed decades of income and tax data and other historical records that try to identify long-term trends about inequality of wealth and income. His conclusion, now this is summarized by Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent at the New York Times. I found this very helpful, and I'll read it for you. Capitalism has a natural drift toward high inequality, as assets like real estate and stocks, disproportionately held by the wealthy, that's capital, rise faster than the economy, that's growth. This process was temporarily reversed by the world wars of the first half of the 20th century, but now inequality in the United States and Europe is rising back toward pre-World War I levels. This is a bad thing, which should be fought through radical policy measures such as a global tax on wealth. That concludes the quote and the summary of Piketty's conclusions by Neil Irwin of the New York Times. Does it matter if our society is becoming more unequal? If it matters, what steps can we take to address it? And what might be their consequences, good and bad, intended and unintended? Our questions for today, some follow-up from our guests. Barbara Morgan is with us again, senior lecturer in economics at the Johns Hopkins University. Michael Reich, professor of social justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And once again, Kenneth R. Solo, Ken Solo, founding partner of Pinnacle Advisory and chief investment guy there. Wealth managers based in Columbia in Howard County. Nice to have you all with us, Ken, Barbara, and Michael. Thanks for joining us again.
Nice to be here.
Thanks.
Why don't we start with that question? It takes us back maybe to two sessions ago when the Piketty book first came out and we first convened to talk about it. Does it matter if our society is becoming unequal? Why do we talk about this to begin with? There's been so much talk about it this year. So this year especially, does it matter? Michael, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it does, and people for centuries, if not thousands of years, have thought that it mattered. Every major religion in the world talks about the need for there to be some kind of equality or greater equality between different levels of society. you know, one of the seven deadly sins was avarice, greed. So I think from a moral standpoint, I think this is something that should resonate with people all over the world. But I think there are also some very concrete practical reasons. One is that there's lots of data that demonstrate that great inequality actually slows economic growth, that a certain amount of inequality might provide individual incentives, but to invest, to work, so forth, to participate in the in a market economy, but that a great deal of inequality actually produces lower rates of growth. Second, that there's lots of data from political scientists that as inequality increases, political and social stability decrease, and the legitimacy that people feel about our social and political institutions also declines. I think that there's a relationship between people's distrust of Congress and other major political institutions and the degree of insecurity they feel because of growing inequality. And finally, a third reason is because inequality is not, it's not just that people who are at the bottom are doing well and people at the top are doing extremely well. It's that people at the bottom and in the middle are doing much worse. So there's a lot more economic and social insecurity in their lives. So another reason is we should be concerned about what the repercussions are of inequality on the quality of people's lives and on their ability to improve their lives in the future, because declining equality is also of outcome is also being accompanied by declining equality of opportunity. So people can't even move outside of the niche into which they are born. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why I think we as a society and globally should be concerned about this.
Barbara, to you too. I just don't want to assume here that this is an important subject that everyone thinks is a problem that should be addressed. How do you see it?
Most of those points I agree with. Let's just recap a little bit. What has happened since 2000? On average, wages have been stagnant, on average household income has fallen, and net wealth has barely moved. They are averages. But if we look at distribution, over 75% of the growth in the economic pie has gone to the top 1%. Wealth distribution is more unequal than income, and it's getting worse. And wealth is very important for things like education, things like starting a small business. The top quintile recovered from the stock market bust and the housing crisis. Most Americans have not. Particularly troubling, I think, is those high earnings in the financial and consulting sectors. They're taking some of the best and brightest of the next generation. That's where they're going. They're leaving our selective colleges to work in these sectors with high levels of compensation that have very little relationship to productivity or economic growth. So we're in a low growth, low investment, trickle-up economy. So I think the consequences are very severe, as Michael said, in terms of innovation, in terms of opportunity. I would also talk a little bit more, say a little bit more, as well as the political impact, the social consequences, because inequality impacts health status, health indicators. It impacts access to education. It impacts family stability and mobility.
Ken Solo, let's hear from you. And last time, I remember the point you made very strongly here was on social mobility and or economic mobility and opportunity that's limited to people who are stuck at the bottom.
Yeah, I think just for me personally, you know, if you're a patriot, if you believe in the American dream, then I think fundamental to who we are is at least everyone should have an equal shot here. I would like to think we all believe in equal opportunity. The nuance here, what I've learned over the very many shows we've done now and my own research, is that the issue is pretty nuanced. And so how you measure inequality, whether you're going to do it by wages or whether you're going to do it by households, we haven't really talked about it, measuring it by consumption, whether you want to do, you know, inequality of spending actually hasn't changed so much since 1978. It's on the income side. What we've learned is that even within the 1%, there are wild differences in inequality. The top 99.99% has skyrocketed in terms of their incomes relative to the rest of the 1%. And when you dig down into the top 10%, that's where you find out it's your neighbor is in your top 10%. You only need $114,000 of household income to be in the top 10% of household earners in the United States. So it gets to be an interesting question. And we tend to focus, I think, on policy. And when you start talking about policies, you have to be careful now, because there are unintended consequences. When you start taking aim at Warren Buffett, he doesn't have a whole lot to do with the rest of the 1%. So it's interesting.
I wasn't even going to bring up Warren Buffett, but that's okay, Ken.
No, that's all right.
Because I know we're talking about, well, not an anomaly, but a very small percentage of Americans in that class.
Well, I mean, right? Look, we just had Jack Ma on the news with Alibaba. There's another mega, mega billionaire. And I was just reading some papers. We'll soon see the first trillionaire. I mean, it's going to happen. So,
you know, we could frame this discussion in terms of talking about the morality of people earning that much money. And I think that would be an interesting conversation. But the problem is not the few who are earning so much money, but the many who are earning so little and have so little life chances and so little wealth and so little opportunity, as Barbara was pointing out. So I think that we have to, you know, discuss the political, economic, social, and even psychological consequences of that for the nation as a whole and for individual populations. I wrote an article in the 1990s that was published in France, but not in the United States, that based upon some research I had done about periods of social reform in the United States. And there, you can't prove cause and effect, but there was a very strong correlation that the periods in which there was the greatest amount of social contact among people of different classes or ethnicities were also the periods in which there was the greatest amount of social reform. Now, you can explain that in a lot of ways. I mean, one way was, for example, the public health movement was inspired because rich people were getting sick as well as poor people. But the problem is today, as a sociologist at Princeton, Doug Massey, has pointed out, is that we basically have a system that's an American version of apartheid, and that there's a great deal of social isolation across class and racial lines. And then what that produces is a lack of understanding of the lives of people, not just at the bottom 10%, but at the bottom half of the income spectrum and the wealth spectrum, and the lack of sensitivity combined with the influence of money in politics produces a great deal of non-responsiveness, to put it euphemistically, toward the needs of that population in terms of policymaking, tax policy, and so forth.
You know, one of the things I wanted to bring up today was, and I mentioned this earlier in the outset, in the introduction, there's been a lot of talk about income inequality, I guess partly because of Piketty's book earlier this year, but also a couple of elections got at least the Democrats excited about using this as a political issue this year, carrying over from 2012 a bit with Obama versus Romney. You had the election victories of an economic populist, Elizabeth Warren, as a U.S. senator, and the New York City mayor, Bill de Blasio. But, you know, when I'm looking at this study from Harvard that I cited at the beginning here on the question of CEO compensation versus average worker. And I don't want to spend too much time on that. But it is indicative of something. It reflects something that people may talk about income inequality and understand that there's been this concentration of wealth over the last 30 years, a long trend, but they don't really get it. They don't that Americans actually don't fully comprehend, appreciate just how wide the gap has become. For instance, here's a survey. I'm going to give it away. I asked folks to call in with their own ideas about what they thought would be appropriate ratio of CEO to worker income. In the United States, people thought in this survey that Harvard University undertook, the business school, people thought it was about 30 to 1. In reality, the gap is roughly 354 to 1. So there's a disconnect there between the reality and also people, what they considered the ideal, Ken, Barbara, and Michael, they considered the ideal ratio to be 7 to 1. And Harvard points out here that that if CEO compensation were to be held constant in that construct, 7 to 1, American workers would have to make $1.8 million a year to get to that ratio, to that gap of 7 to 1. So what is it about this? People, hopefully they're listening in today and wondering, okay, I accept that. I'll go along with you. And we even have the Fed numbers from February to back up what Barbara was saying about the widening gap. Well, what do you do about it? That's the question. What do you do about it? A public consensus? There doesn't seem to be a consensus on the cause exactly. All right. Or or what you do to counter the trend?
Well, I think the answer is pretty obvious. First, stop people from aging, because the statistics are very clear. Probably three-quarters of income inequality, just come from the fact that baby boomers are aging, and that demographic, especially when they're two-earner households, make extraordinary amounts of money relative to the bottom 10%. Stop people from getting married. Stop people from getting a college education. And if we do these things, then income inequality will go away very quickly. So it's my facetious way of making the point here that much of the cause of this is structural, and that, yes, focusing on CEO comp is one part of this, which we've talked about. The attitudes of boards of major corporation and the cultural norms for CEO comp have become distorted. But frankly, demographics is a huge issue. The number of single families is a gigantic issue. I sent this around in America right now.
You mean single head of household?
Yeah, for the first time in the history of the country, we have more single head of households than married just recently. Globalization, competing for these jobs is a huge thing. You have the increase in the dollar, which has created slower growth. You have policies that encourage debt. So as Michael has pointed out in the past, for the middle class, they've used debt and accumulating debt to mask some of this deterioration in what's gone on with our middle class. You have declines in the minimum wage in real terms, unionization. One of my favorites, as you know, crony capitalism as a problem. So it's a very broad-based type of an issue. Hard to get your hands around any one of those as you come up with solutions.
Well, I'm not quite sure where to start because there's a lot of factors there.
Well, we need to take a break.
Okay.
So can you hold your thoughts?
I'll hold my thought.
Barbara Morgan from Johns Hopkins, Michael Rice from the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and just speaking then was Ken Sola of Pinnacle Advisory based in Columbia, Maryland. Please join our conversation. If there's a point you'd like to make, a question you'd like to raise about income inequality, as we continue our conversations here with Michael Rice, Barbara Morgan, and Ken Sola. On Midday, 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here along with Barbara Morgan, Senior Lecturer in Economics at Johns Hopkins, Michael Rice, Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and Ken Sola, Founding Partner of Pinnacle Advisory Group Wealth Managers in Columbia, Maryland, as we continue our conversations about income inequality and wealth inequality, the wealth gap in the United States and around the world. Barbara, we left off with you. Barbara Morgan
sure.
from Hopkins.
Okay, just one to pick up on one point that Ken said. It's not demographics. It's not totally driven by demographics. If it were demographics, we wouldn't see the same pattern in earnings, but we do. There's big dispersion in terms of earnings. So it's not driven by households. It's driven by earnings differences to a large degree. And if we look at different types of jobs, some jobs are high skill, high earnings. Some are low skill, low earnings. We've talked about this before. We have had a shift from manufacturing to services. What we see in the service sector is a much greater dispersion of earnings. In other words, some jobs are very high skill and high earnings. Others are low skill and low earnings. You mm-hmm. can think of healthcare, for example, where we have very highly paid skilled surgeons and then individuals who may surgical
technicians.
Patients on a routine basis
right,
who are very low skill. Uh-huh. Now, the thing about that dispersion is the jobs that have the high earnings versus the low earnings get a lot more benefits and good characteristics compared to the low paid jobs. The low paid jobs get few or no benefits in terms of health and pensions. They have unpredictable schedules generally, both in terms of the quantity of hours, which varies by the week, and the notice that you get. So that means there's a lot of instability. There's a lot of variability of earnings. It's very, very tough for families. Low-income families have less time to help their kids, and they can't predict what's going to happen. They can't predict their earnings from one week to the next. I can come up with some policies if you
We will during this hour. Michael.
I think we have to point out a couple of so many paths we can enter into this conversation. But one thing is that the distribution of income and wealth among the elderly is very similar to the distribution of income and wealth among the rest of the population. A majority of people who are elderly depend for 50 to 90% of their income on Social Security itself. So this notion that, you know, we have these white-shoed folks who all they do is play golf all day is really a myth. And it's exacerbated by issues of gender and race. I mean, the poverty among elderly people of color, and especially elderly women of color, is very significant. And that leads us to another issue around this issue of wealth inequality, and that's the racial wealth gap. The racial wealth gap in this country is absolutely striking. I don't have the specific data in front of me, but the difference between the net worth of the average white household and the average African-American household is startling. And without that basis of wealth, it's impossible not only to grow economically, but also to provide opportunity for one's children.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. And I give the phone number again because I like to include our listeners in this conversation with comments and questions for our guests, Ken Solo, Barbara Morgan, and Michael Reich. Does this conversation trouble you? Does it make you uncomfortable? A lot of people don't like to talk about this. They think it's, there are accusations of class warfare that come up whenever we have this conversation with some people. It makes them uncomfortable. Some people scratch their heads and wonder, what do you do about it? And the question is, you know, income, wealth inequality, at the scale we're seeing it today, is this a problem for our country? You hear the word inequality and you assume, well, that's a bad thing. The question is, what do you do about it, if anything? Or is there a resignation in the public? Are people just sort of resigned to this and wondering, you know, I'll never get a piece of that. I've fallen further and further behind. The numbers back this up, by the way. The Federal Reserve, I mentioned this Federal Reserve report that came out about a month ago now, the gap between the richest and poorest Americans widened even as the U.S. economic recovery gained traction in the years following the recession, according to the Federal Reserve. I'm reading here from a Dow Jones report published in the Wall Street Journal. Average or mean pre-tax income for the wealthiest 10% of U.S. families rose 10% in 2013 from 2010. But families in the bottom 40% saw their average inflation-adjusted income decline over that same period. Middle and upper middle class families in the 40th through 90th percentiles saw little change in take-home pay, and so failed to recover the losses experienced between 2007 and 2010. And there's that loss of wealth or assets that you're talking about, Barbara, that can fund education, that can fund housing for people, right?
Yes, that exactly is what has happened, that basically everyone except at the top 20% have actually recovered in terms of wealth. So their wealth is now about $60,000 on average higher. But everybody else has not recovered from the housing bust. They've not recovered from the stock market fall. And that cushion is so important. Otherwise, just one little thing can knock you right out of the labor market.
Ken, I wanted to go to you with this question. This is, we're going to talk about problems. We're past that question of establishing that there's a problem here. And the question of what to do about it next. Piketty's idea is a global tax on wealth, right? So we might as well talk about taxation a little bit here and taxation policy. You have some specific ideas about that.
Well, I don't know that any of my ideas are original, but in my mind, I see the solutions to this. We end up talking about breaking the cycle of poverty, which you can talk about forever. And I think, at least I'm afraid that people are kind of resigned to it at this point. You know, how long have we been after these same issues? I was thinking of Johnson's
War on Poverty.
War on Poverty, you know, it's 50 years ago or however long it is. But I think the answers are, to me anyway, in three areas. One is tax policy, although frankly, I think Piketty is something of a lunatic, but just general tax policy is, I think, important. And the other is in education. And the other is, in my mind, figuring out how to create partnerships between to bring business into this equation and to find interesting new ways to do public-private partnerships that result in jobs. And that if you can get that marriage between education and jobs, I think that's the piece that is always missing. You know, we focus on education, but without the jobs, especially in the cities, especially here, let's say in Baltimore as an example, I'm not quite sure you get to any place new. And there are some great examples of those types of partnerships. There are some interesting new ideas about educational changes. And clearly in tax policy, so I mean, the tax policy ones to me that are most interesting are pretty simple, where you combine a VAT tax, which is a value-added tax. It's a tax on consumption, where in all the models I've seen, you exempt low earners from this tax. So you get $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 of spending without paying the tax, which protects the poor, but you're taxing wealthy people who do most of the expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you create a income tax that's much flatter. So maybe the top rate is in the mid-20s somewhere with no exemptions. So what happens is, and again, the low earners are exempt from the income tax. So what happens is you end up with a very progressive tax that's simplified and where the incentives are on saving and investing. And we're no longer encouraging spending.
Very interesting, Ken. Thank you for laying that out. Piketty's idea, Michael Reich, of a global tax is to compensate to fund programs that would raise the lower classes. Right.
And I support the idea in principle. I don't know how feasible it is, but we could do things in the United States. For example, we could tax unearned income at the same rate as earned income. We could make some modest adjustments in the overall marginal tax rate to bring it back closer to where it was at the start of the Reagan administration. We could fund more of our programs through progressive graduated income tax rather than through regressive sales tax. The only reason that the VAT tax is not as regressive in Scandinavia as it might be in the United States is that it's compensated for by redistributive policies in the area of health, family allowances, social services, education, and the like.
Child care.
And I don't see any trend in the United States in that direction. Another modest thing is we could expand the provisions of the earned income tax credit, which is something that has bipartisan support. Right now, a single wage earner is not eligible for it. It's only for families. Since many, as Ken said, since many households are now headed by single wage earners, why not expand it? Why limit it to families of only a particular size? The idea of a carbon tax that is compensated for by changes in the tax rate on income might be another solution, which would also have positive environmental impact. We could raise the cap on the income that people earn in order to pay Social Security tax, which would make that tax somewhat less regressive. And finally, you know, the American economy is not going to rebound fully in a manner that's equitable simply by restoring the manufacturing sector to where it was, you know, in the middle of the 20th century. It's not going to happen. There's a lot of forces in the world that will prevent that from happening. But we could, you know, recapture some of the innovation that fueled the economy in the first place, you know, 100 years ago, and do it at the local level, create more green industry, for example, invest in innovation at the local level in Maryland and Baltimore. There's lots of bright people here. There's lots of people who need work. There's lots of capital in this area. And that's the kind of thing I think that might eventually percolate up to the national level.
Barbara, I'll go to you, and then we'll go to the phone lines for our listeners.
I think a lot of those suggestions are very good. I don't think we have to be totally dismal. If we look at the record of policies have worked. The minimum wage worked. Earned income tax credit worked. Okay, Head Start worked. It's just that we are not supporting those policies sufficiently, and that's part of the problem. I would be very interested in private-public partnerships. I would be very interested in firms providing high-quality jobs. But unfortunately, that doesn't often happen. That's the problem. Okay, so take the issue of parental leave, which I think is a very important issue.
Parental leave.
Yeah, mm-hmm. for to help families for a limited period of time who've just had a kid, right? We have a federal policy. It's one of the worst in the world. It's unpaid 12 weeks. It only reaches about 50% of the population. And when I say it's one of the worst in the world, there's only three countries, including Papua New Guinea, Suriname, that has a policy of unpaid leave. Okay, now, again, we have this issue of inequality across firms. Google has a very good family leave policy that they realized it was a very good idea because they were losing high-skilled women, and now they're retaining those high-skilled women that they've invested in. It's a little bit tougher at the low end of the labor market. Firms don't, these workers are less skilled, firms have less interest in retaining them, and so that's why I think that you have to have a federal policy. The firms are not going to do it.
They don't even have paid sick leave, many of these workers.
We're going to go to the phone lines and take some comments from our listeners and then hear from our panelists again. That was Barbara Morgan, Michael Reich, and Ken Solo here on Midday. Hart in Cockeysville, thank you for holding. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I think that the problem isn't inequality. It's just not addressing poverty in this country. I mean, if you gave every poor person in this country $1 million, do you think that anybody would really care about income inequality? I mean, it's a stalking horse for taking care of the poor. I have no objection to that personally. I think that you should take care of the poor. But how they're going about it by creating this class warfare and criticizing wealthy for being productive and actually earning more than anybody else, I think it's offensive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think, the discussion here has been about creating economic opportunity. A lot of this is our third session here.
Right, but I think
I don't know
caller,
if we're talking about extending or augmenting the welfare state, which is what I
hear.
I think
the caller is right, though, and that oftentimes in this conversation, as we talk about inequality, we don't talk about the productivity of the higher earners. I mean, we're not celebrating the high earners the way we should. Okay, and as the caller says, we often run very close to demonizing them, and the fact is that it's, in my mind, is exactly correct that the productivity. So when we're creating billionaires, instead of this being an evil issue, as you would get if you read Piketty, it's something we should all stand up and applaud and say, what are the benefits of society? How many jobs are being created?
Well, I look at the source of the wealth. You know, is it coming from productivity? Is it helping growth?
Very good point.
Is it creating jobs? That was my point.
This whole issue of productivity is a bogus issue, as far as I'm concerned. What is being productive about a CEO that justifies an income 354 times the wage of a worker producing a good, a commodity in that factory that is then being sold? What is the productivity of a hedge fund manager that's earning $1 billion a year? And it's also by implication disparaging the productivity of lower income workers as if they have no value in the economy, that they're not working hard. In fact, American workers are the most productive workers in the world by every statistical measure. So at the same time as productivity has risen, there's this disparagement of workers and people who are unemployed as if they don't want to be productive, while we celebrate the so-called productivity of the people at the very top of the income and wealth spectrum.
Michael, the 0.01% that are CEOs making the kind of money you're talking about and the hedge fund managers and all that is truly a straw man. That is not the 1%. The 1% are those folks that really are the small business owners in the United States. They are the risk takers. I can tell you because I've worked with them my entire career. For many of them, they've accumulated their wealth through a lifetime of thrift and saving and doing what you're supposed to do. The fact that we can celebrate them in no way denigrates the productivity of our poor or of the lower 10% or 20%. It's simply drawing a distinction between this cartoon caricature we have of the uber-rich people out there who represent, I think Barbara and I were sharing some emails. What did we say? Maybe 130,000 households.
You don't agree with Piketty's conclusion after looking at a couple of centuries of data on taxation and income that there is a natural drift in capitalism toward high inequality as assets like real estate, stocks, disproportionately held by the wealthy already, rise faster than growth.
I didn't say I disagree. What I disagree with Piketty is that he has nothing to say about productivity. He calls Bill Gates a product of luck. He has nothing to say about philanthropy and the wealthy. He is wrong in terms of his thinking about investing, which happens to be my field, as he says that the uber rich can generate huge percentage increases in wealth because of their investment tools and techniques. So, and he's certainly wrong in terms of inherited wealth, which is one of my biggest concerns, in that if you read him, he would say 70% of the wealth, I think, is inherited, and that's not the case.
Barbara, do you want to say something?
Yeah, I don't think we're talking the politics of envy. I don't think we're demonizing. We're talking the politics of fairness and the politics of growth. That's exactly what we're talking about. And the economy is not growing to the advantage of everyone. Americans, not just the ones in the top, work extremely hard. They work harder than workers in any other country of the world, any developed country of the world, except, I think, for Korea. They work extremely long hours. And, in fact, the gap in hours between the United States and other countries is greater at the bottom of the distribution. Our low-wage workers work longer hours for a lower standard of living than in any of the OECD countries.
Let's take another call. Phil in Baltimore. Go right ahead, please. Hi.
Well, I really appreciate it. This is exactly the point I wanted to make. When I was a younger person in the 70s, I remember seeing a film on a worker-owned factory in Spain. And one of the issues they had to determine was, how do they determine what the guy who was running the factory versus the people who were on the line? They made an arbitrary decision at that time that it could be 40 times on the. And one of the things that did, of course, meant that the executive at the top cared about what they were earning and would increase their earnings, because when they increased earnings there, his salary increased. I think that one of the things about productivity, it's just very hard to say where we stop with that. Bill Gates founded Microsoft, okay, did a lot, but it's so one sense I feel he has a right. On the other hand, people who buy up companies, they didn't make that wealth. I'm not sure they involve. I guess my problem is that I think people need to get rewarded. I think that some people are going to make more money, and that's not bad. That's good. We're in a small business.
I think we concede that. The question here is in the gap between those who are making it and continue to make it and make it and make it and make it, and those who are for whom wages are flat. That's number one. And for people who are losing in the recession, lost wealth, lost their houses, some people.
Let me just give two examples. Why should, in fact, people who are, when the company makes more money, why should the worker who's at the bottom make more money? They don't, often.
Yeah.
Secondly,
well, that's evident from, I mean, the numbers indicate that over the last 30 years.
And if you look at Google, they brought up Google, and Google is a very good company. But one of the things I happen to know, because I had a nephew who worked there, they employ a lot of time, non-permanent contract, short-term workers who get no real benefits. Yeah. I mean, they get to work at a nice place, but they're getting paid minimum wage.
Phil, thank you very much for your comments. We have to take a break here, folks. We'll come back and take some more calls. 410-662-8780. This is Midday. Welcome back to Midday. Ken, you were talking about the potential in private-public partnerships here. One that we can talk about, I thought I would mention, is what's been going on in the Port of Baltimore with the Port Authority, the Port Administration, and Ports America down there, with the expansion of the port in preparation for Panamax cargo containers coming through the widened Panama Canal. I mean, that's one of the more exciting economic stories in our region here, and that's come off from an investment through a private corporation and the state of Maryland working together on that. So I think that's the kind of thing you're talking about. There's just enough of it.
I would go broader. The ones I'm talking about, I happen to have a chance to have a long conversation with Catherine Hetherington, who's the president of Howard County Community College, about the roles of community college in workforce development. Yeah. You know, how do you train kids in the city to be prepared for the jobs that might be available? Community colleges have a role. And she was explaining some of these partnerships where businesses come into a town. They get very good incentives in terms of low interest loans, tax breaks. The educational community provides workforce development for these businesses. And then the businesses are contractually obligated to hire percentages of those workers in the city, and that those, or in the area, and that type of a partnership is really intriguing to me.
I was talking about the money kind of partnership.
But I mean, at the end of the day, it's all about the money. And what I worry,
and not just public money, not just raising taxes to pay for these things. They want to put a maglev system in, magnetic levitation train that goes 300 miles an hour. Great idea, but show me the money. I'm all for the private-public partnership.
But, I mean, J.P. Morgan is coming into Detroit with $100 million right now. Okay, believe me, they're not doing it for altruistic reasons.
Right. Here's an email. I wanted to read a couple emails and go back to the phone lines. Jane says, I'm a high-productivity, low-income American with a college degree and a lifetime of job experience. Due to circumstances beyond my control, I have had to go from job to job each time I start at the bottom again. If you think the rich are being demonized, try my end of the pay scale. Thank you, Jane. Cam writes in to say, we should view income inequality in its broader historical context. I think Thomas Piketty tried to do that. The disturbing truth is that the great inequality has been the norm for all of human history since the rise of the earliest empires and kingdoms, the period of relative equality in North America and Europe in the post-war era was a minor aberration. This just highlights the need for citizens to fight tooth and nail to maintain what little relative income equality remains. History is stacked against us, and this is increasingly important as economic power continues trending towards greater political power. Let's go back to the phone lines. David calling from San Francisco. I believe that's in California. Thank you for calling Midday.
Yeah, greetings. It's still early here. Hey, you know, I'm glad somebody raised Detroit there a moment ago. Just doing a simple Google search of David Stockman plus Collins Aikens, you'll get into how Detroit collapsed. And, of course, David Stockman was Ronald Reagan's
buddy. Okay. Do you have a question for us, please, because we're short of time?
Well, yeah, sure. It regards economic education. If the children of America are supposed to be growing up to be capitalists, we should be trained in economics. Right now, we're in a very obvious thing called hyperinflation. And it all has a lot to
okay.
do with
David,
criminality.
I'm sorry, we're off the subject.
Can't get into criminality.
We're off the subject. Okay, we'll go to Stephanie in Baltimore. Didn't follow that at all. So, Stephanie, we're talking about income inequality and the wealth gap here. Stephanie, go right ahead, please.
Hi, I was curious what the guests thought about promoting alternate models such as worker-owned cooperatives as a way to reduce inequality.
That was one of the things I was alluding to in my conversation about local growth, that worker-owned cooperatives such as the Mondragon cooperatives in the Basque region of Spain might be a good model of that. There are small, very small versions of that in places like Cleveland, in the San Francisco Bay Area. There's a bakery cooperative there in Oakland called Arizmendi, which happens to make delicious bread and pizza and other things. There are laundry cooperatives, and there are some efforts being made in West Baltimore to create them. I think that they're very good ideas, but they are relatively small scale. We need to take them to a larger scale and find a way to link them together so that they can have a broader regional impact.
Barbara?
I think for some small firms, that model works very well. I don't think it's going to explode across the economy, but I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago where the CEO of the firm, I think, was called Tweezerman. That was his model, and there was input from
Tweezerman
input from all of the employees, and he finally sold the firm. The janitor got $50,000 and kept his job.
Well, that sounds downright exciting.
But I think it's important to emphasize that all the things that we've been talking about can only be pieces of a larger strategy. There's no single silver bullet that can eliminate this problem. There has to be national as well as local solutions to it, and both public and private sector. Can't be one answer to solve this issue.
It's interesting. I'm glad Stephanie brought that up. Thank you very much. Tom in Rosedale, we'll go to you next. You're on Midday. Hi.
Hi, Dan. Have a good afternoon here. My thought is that if anything's going to change, we need a war on inequality that's controlled by the public, meaning the power of boycott. Imagine if every newspaper printed the list of all the names of these CEOs and their corporations and their compensation so that everybody could get a newspaper, hold on to it, and then decide which companies or corporations they were going to boycott and not buy their product.
Well, you know, I'm sort of for what you say, and some of that reporting is done, but the ratio isn't reported. I mean, the Forbes list comes out, and we see Kevin Plank from Under Armour on the Forbes list of the 400 richest Americans, and Steve Bisciotti, the owner of the Ravens. They're on it, but I don't know what their employees make. So we don't see the ratio. I'd be more interested in the ratio. I'm not going to knock Steve Bisciotti and Kevin Plank for making the money they make. Plank is worth $3 billion, according to Forbes, up from $1.7 billion years ago. I mean, his the stock is more valuable. The company's become more valuable. I just like to know what his workers are making. So that's when you'll be fully informed, I think, on that count. Frank, we'll go to Frank in Hampstead next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had two questions, comments. Number one, businesses are always complaining that they're overtaxed and overburdened with regulations and that government is a problem. Government should get out of the way and just let them make money. And magically, you know, we'll all be rich. But what is missing from the equation is the role of government in creating the infrastructure that allows business to run. And without that infrastructure, business couldn't do anything. Yet business doesn't want to pay for it. And the other question or comment I have is one of your guests said that the person at the top of the company is the most productive and should be paid. Well, you could have the greatest idea in the world, but if you don't have a competent workforce to carry out that idea for you, you're not going to make any money.
Okay.
So you should compensate your workers.
Thank you. Thank you for those points, Ken.
Well,
I think he's talking about you.
It's stunning, really. So the caller is talking about businesses as though businesses are an evil entity in themselves, the evil empire of business. There are thousands and thousands.
I didn't hear him say that.
I'm reading it, and I'm laughing about it. What I said, and I want to be clear about this, I did not say that the owners of businesses are more productive. What I said was nowhere in the conversation about rising incomes of the 1% is there an acknowledgement that they are creating jobs and doing positive things, and that the fact that they're making a lot of money is not a problem. That's not the problem. So that was all my point. So when someone says this, they want to talk about expenditures, all I can think of is right off the bat, the reason I was smiling as well, they didn't build that.
Right.
They didn't build that. Well,
yeah.
They did. And for the most part, they did.
Michael.
Well, two points that the caller inspired. One is that, you know, businesses complain about regulations, but actually regulations have been proven to be economically prudent. Because if we didn't control pollution, it would create more health problems. And secondly, there's a longer-term issue, and that's changing cultural norms. We've equated wealth with virtue in this country, and I think we have to try to find a way to eradicate that, because it's the other side of it is that we equate poverty with vice, and I think that has very damaging social consequences.
Michael Reich is a professor of social justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work in downtown Baltimore. Ken Solo, founding partner and chief investment officer at Pinnacle Advisory, based in Howard County in Columbia. And Barbara Morgan is a senior lecturer in economics at the Johns Hopkins University. All three join us from time to time to talk about income and wealth inequality and the general economy. Thank you so much for being here again. I enjoy these conversations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our first hour of Midday. We'll take a break for lunch, brought to us by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market, and then we'll see you for the second hour.